Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. In this hour, we're talking about the future of farming in Wisconsin. America's dairyland lost 660 cow herds as of November 1st, and the number of herds in the state has been nearly cut in half over the last 15 years, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. In this hour, we're talking about the challenges facing farmers and what's being done to help keep them in business. Tricia Wagner is the Farm Management Program Outreach Coordinator for UW Extension. She spoke with me yesterday by phone about some of the factors driving farms out of business and attempts to pinpoint new revenue streams for producers.
The changes that we've seen in the industry sector in particular, they're not new. It's been, you know, a trend of decreasing in the number of herds or number of farms in our state since, I believe, they started record keeping on this topic. And the number of cows has remained slightly steady while production has increased. So, you know, the takeaway from that information is that our farms are becoming much more efficient. They're getting better at their job of producing food for us. And that, you know, in some ways is considered a good thing, but in many ways we're seeing, you know, in that data, what you see when you drive down any road in Wisconsin, where you have some of the older, smaller barns that are being left empty. And we have bigger, newer barns going up, but it does result in, you know, fewer individual or small businesses. But many cases, the next generation of farmers. Maybe it's, you know, brothers and sisters now operating the business. In recent years, particularly in the last year, that kind of trend has been like accelerating. It's, you know, wouldn't say it's necessarily exponentially grown, but it's definitely accelerated. And yeah, the statistics have been reported on regarding the number of farms that we've lost in the last year. The projections for 2019, you know, don't show a solution to that. It doesn't seem like 19 is going to be like the year of the recovery. So with that being said, I think many farms are thinking about, you know, the future of their business, of their operation, what it means for their family, what it means to the next generation of farmers. And they're thinking about the options. And, you know, I think farmers in general, they are very optimistic. And they know that in times of economic challenges, there's often opportunity. And they'll look for that. And they're excellent at finding those. So there are some farms that are thinking about the resources that they have, whether it's their current assets, you know, facilities and equipment, and also maybe it's the skills, knowledge, and ability that is brought to the business by new people on the farm, whether that's, you know, son or daughter coming back to the business or son or daughter-in-law coming back to the business, and what can they bring and what are their passions that they want to bring. So there's people trying some new things, and, you know, it's not necessarily to say that they're going to give up or end or necessarily exit their original enterprise in all cases, but maybe it's an additional revenue stream that is coming onto the farm that might just help pay some of the bills. Of course, there's time and effort and resources that go into those types of ventures as well.
Yeah, and I imagine, you know, at this time when I'm assuming most of the harvest is over for people, but I suppose some might be still out there late. But, you know, now that they have time in the winter to think about what their game plan is going to be going into next year, people are going to be thinking about whether or not they want to make changes, right?
Right. I think you're exactly right. This is a time of the year where, you know, a lot of people are looking at their records. They're meeting with their professional consults, and they're talking about, you know, next year, talking about cost of production, they're talking about operating loans, and they're looking at some ideas of, you know, what they want to do in 2019.
Well, and UW Extension is holding a Resilient Farms Conference next week in the Dells to help farmers diversify or find new revenue streams. So what is this conference going to be covering?
Yeah, the conference really is an opportunity for a farmer-to-farmer, peer-to-peer networking and learning opportunity. The number of topics covered is vast. Many different types of farmers coming in to share their type of business enterprise and talk to farmers that are interested in learning about that, so that they can get an idea of, you know, what were some of the resources that went into the business, what were some of the outlay of costs prior to getting it off the ground, and, you know, what were some of the successes and challenges that they found along the way, so that farmers can really learn from other farmers as to what they learned, what they did, and so they can use that information and think about it for their own ideas. It'll also be an opportunity to hear from professionals who can provide consultation on a business idea. So one of the resources at the conference will be Farm Commons, and they are a legal professional that focuses much of their resources on new business development, value-added, liability and insurance, and legal issues as it pertains to those topics, everything from, you know, having consumers or customers on your farm to having events on the farm, contracts you may enter into with processing of value-added products, those sort of topics.
I guess, are there any particular ideas that are gaining ground right now in Wisconsin?
Well, we've seen, you know, a lot of growing trends in local foods, consumers interested in being connected to the farm. And so developing that connection between the farm and the customer and how that's done, you know, whether it's through farmers markets or having people at the farm, UPIC operations, CSA type of marketing. So we've seen these various strategies for direct marketing really gain interest in recent years. In addition, there's all sorts of other topics like agritourism. There's alternative crops. We've seen things like hop production grow in our state. Also, you know, recently hemp production became legal, and so there's people interested in that avenue as well.
I guess, is there any particular thing that you're hearing from farmers? Is, you know, they might be stressed to the max right now, at least with the dairy industry, that they're considering as they're looking at either, you know, new sources of revenue or cutting costs?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, there's a general interest in diversification and thinking about what are the different ways that a farm can do some diversification. And really, it takes some analysis of what skills, knowledge, and ability the current business members have and want to spend some time focusing on. And some of it's kind of that introspection and looking at that, and some of it's kind of hearing from what other people learned in their process of developing a diversified aspect of their business.
You mentioned interest in new crops, or you mentioned interest in hemp production, which was allowed by state lawmakers in just the past year. Do you think that that's going to see growth, or do you think that more farmers are considering that as a potential crop because of some of the challenges that we're seeing, maybe with retaliatory tariffs with corn and soybeans?
It's definitely a question, I think, right now. You know, I think farmers are looking at, you know, their production and income on an acre basis, and they're saying, okay, you know, our traditional commodities aren't bringing the returns that we'd like to see. I don't think that means they're going to necessarily stop producing those commodities, but, you know, it's definitely a cause for motivation to take a look at an alternative, and maybe you try something out on a small acreage level for a year, and you kind of get a little bit of experience in, you know, what it takes to grow a different type of crop. And farmers are kind of interested in learning about, you know, the agronomics of growing a new type of commodity, and you know, what some of the marketing of that means. And of course, there's new and some real challenges involved, and hearing about, you know, how farmers have met those challenges and what they learned. I think, you know, there's a lot of people interested in how the crop is being used, the oil from the seed, and how it's being, how consumers are using it and what the market has been for that.
Right, as far as like licensed retailers that they can sell to, because that seems to be kind of a gray area in state law right now.
Yeah, I mean, and I think another component of the conference is that we'll have representatives from the Department of Agriculture to provide some consultation on questions they might have on some topics with regard to licensing and regulation of regarding the new hemp production rules and also rules and regulations for, you know, value-added products in general, what some of the labeling requirements are, rules on processing, that type of thing.
I guess, what are you hoping to see for the farming community, which is pretty diverse in itself? You know, we have all different kinds of crops and producers across the state, whether it's, you know, beef or pork or dairy or, you know, corn and soybeans. So what are you hoping to see for the farming community as things move forward into the new year?
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously I hope for, you know, more profitable year ahead. And I hope that farmers can continue to pursue their passion and lifestyle and really their, you know, goals for their farm, for their business, for their family. You know, the role that Resilient Farms Conference can play in that is that I'm hoping that it will allow farmers the opportunity to get a lot of their questions answered so that they can gather the information they need to make good decisions, and so that when they go into consideration for diversifying their business, that they do that with the best information possible and that they make good decisions for their business, whether that means to pursue a new idea or whether it means to learn that, whoa, you know, that's not the idea for our farm. But whatever that is, they learned from their connections and from speaking with people who are knowledgeable in that area, and they make the best decision for them, for themselves and for their business, for their family.
Well, is there anything else about the conference that you would like to add?
We realized that, you know, we wanted to have the conference in a central location in our state so it would be most accessible to as many people as possible, but we realized that, you know, traveling and leaving the farm for a day isn't always possible for everyone. And so a number of UW Extension County offices around the state, particularly in our rural areas, will make a live stream of the conference accessible. And so if there are folks interested in that, please check the website and information for contact information for those county offices where the program can be accessed.
Again, you were just listening to Tricia Wagner, Farm Management Program Outreach Coordinator for UW Extension. Up next, we hear from Jane Anklum. She's the UW Extension Agriculture and Horticulture Educator for Douglas County. Last year, the county completed an update of its farmland preservation plan. Anklum talks about how the county hopes to promote sustainable farming in the area.
What their farmland preservation plan tried to do is recognize the qualities that they have, but they also turn to the idea that we have to think of different ways to make our systems resilient to change. And throughout the plan, there's a lot of discussion about how to diversify our agriculture and how to incorporate local food or local product or value added from our agricultural products to our local market or to our larger market. How can our products be brought out to the community and our money kept locally? You know, maybe you know it's true that when you have fewer farms, you also have fewer services for farmers, like veterinary, like machinery, like agricultural consultants. And so with all that, they have to travel farther to market and farther to get services. And then add that, you know, certainly in the last 10 years, we've experienced increasing storm flow, storm events that wash out our roads, flood our fields, make it harder to get in, make it harder to get out. And that's not going to decrease. That's something the climate change information is going to increase. So helping our farmers and our county acknowledge that and address that in a sustainable way is also reflected in the plan.
Okay. Well, I guess I wanted to take a step back because you talked about the challenge that Douglas County is facing. It's not a CAFO, it's not development, it's a loss of farmers. So do you know about how many farmers we have in the county right now?
You know, when I work with farmers, I talk about the number, you know, around 200 farmers, let's say, and that runs the gamut. And that's not, you know, we might even have increasing farmers with decreasing farmland has you know, it maybe gets split up. We've got farmers that are in Douglas County. At least I've noticed over my, you know, whatever 10 years that I've been here, seems to be intentional. They're sharp. They're trying to close the gaps on loss. They're thoughtful about what they're doing. In terms of applying the most recent technology to make things work. We're lucky in Douglas County to have two milk haulers, Burnett Dairy and Organic Valley. That's where our dairy farmers ship to. And both of them have weathered storms and have come out fine-tuning their market. And so they're able to keep our farmers on their lines. And dairy farming is an important across the state of Wisconsin, and it's really important in Douglas County because they're the farmers that are keeping the hay crops on the ground. They're learning how to feed, you know, they'll enter markets like organic markets or like grass-fed milk, and they are adapting to how to make a dollar on our soils in our climate. So we've definitely lost some farmers in the last 10 years, and we've lost dairy farmers in Douglas County. We've only got a handful, you know, like six at the most right now, and that might be stretching it.
And so as you've seen these changes over the years, what's happening? Are they just completely getting out, or are they trying new things?
I think it's a little of both. I get calls from people that I haven't worked with or that are coming from another state and looking at Wisconsin as a potential place to determine if they've got the infrastructure to work on new production models. They're coming from a different career and they're interested in farming, or they've been farming and they're trying to figure out how to close the gap and to add value to what they have now. We've got some young farmers coming on online, and they're willing to look at different ways of doing things. Talking about, we do have a local food market in Douglas County. A lot of it is from farmer to farmer or farmer to family. We've got some farmers that are engaging in marketing their stuff through CSAs or through a farmer's market or to restaurants or to grocery chains. Or online, we're hoping to try to understand that, our ability in Douglas County to provide for our market demand. Or have we already saturated the local market? And do we have to look elsewhere to sell our products? Or do we have to develop new products to meet the demands and the interests of the consumer?
So as things move on in the future, what is the vision that the county has kind of set for the future for agriculture in the county? What does that look like?
Well, they, you know, in the farmland preservation, I can tell you that they're looking at a more diverse array of products. Having zoning policies that protect farmland versus make it more vulnerable to development. Managing their forests to best management practice and including forest as an agricultural land use. And that's something that is evolving around the country and the state. We've got very productive forests, and in Douglas County has got an opportunity for private landowners and farmers to manage their forests for agricultural products and for fiber products and wood. Maintaining the current balance of forest, agriculture, and recreational land, and that's a big, you know, that's a big order. If farmers are not farming all their land all the time, then it does start growing back to trees or to brush. How do we consider maintaining that agricultural base if we're not maintaining the farmland itself. And then preservation of historically farmed and prime farmlands, that's kind of an objective. When you look at Douglas County, there are certain parts of the county, and this is true of Bayfield and Ashland and Iron County and well over into Minnesota, the impact of Lake Superior does give us an edge that some farmers to the south of us don't have in terms of our climate. So that's something to be carefully thoughtful of in how we develop and how we choose to maintain the roads and the infrastructure in those areas so that the farmers can consider that they've got a place to continue to grow and to continue to invest their money.
Do you mean as far as like longer growing seasons, or do you mean as far as some of the changes that we've seen in climate over the years?
Oh, a little of both. That's a great question. We do get a benefit of the lake in terms of our growing season. Our hardiness is a little longer up there. Our falls are a little longer up there. That's important. And then as far as climate change, you know, any streams that flow into Lake Superior are going to be getting more water faster. And you know, our part of the state, if you look at the maps, you'll notice that our nighttime temperatures are getting warmer. We have longer periods of time where we can count on drier weather. That those kind of things are things that farmers need to consider not in how they choose their crops, but also how the community needs to understand how valuable that the soils are in sequestering carbon, and our farmers do that through their agricultural grass practices up here. We're holding that climate or that carbon in, and we're slowing the flow of the water across the land, and that helps maintain our roads. So that farmland provides a lot of service for us in Douglas County.
Well, I guess as you're looking to the future, then you talked about value-added marketing. So, what kind of things are you focusing on with farmers, or what are some of the things that are happening? You know, like mm-hmm. I hear a lot about community-supported agriculture. Is mm-hmm. that kind of what you're doing, or yeah. are there other things?
Yeah, you know that we've had a run. Let's say a local food organization, a local food team, let's say, through Extension and through our partners, that talks about how can we enhance or make us all aware of our choices, our local food choices. And the CSAs and the farmers market have been doing their best to make, again, sustainable, profitable for them and provide choices to the community. Some of our farmers have been, let's say they sell meat products or eggs or chickens, making that more accessible, making that helping them to consider if they want to expanding their sales. And expanding their sales, how do they manage for a business to take in account the cost involved with expanding your sales? So it's a lot of business planning, the technical, how to raise the animals and how to cut cost or increase cost on animal feed and veterinary and marketing, but to have a business plan that your local banks and loaners will support. There's a link there that we need to enhance. And then understanding that if you grow it, you have to and spend your local capital in it, you have to charge for that product in order to make it sustainable. So I think it's a lot on the business end, and then connecting the public to that, those outputs. The distance between the farmer and the consumer, there's that gap in the middle. We've got farmers in Douglas County that produce candies from their dairy product, let's say, or soaps and creams from their dairy product. We've got a farmer, at least one, that is starting to wonder, how do you do on-farm ice cream, for instance? How do you get from, milking my 100 cows every day to adding that to the whole situation? How does health regulations come into it? Can I have the public on my farm? What do I do about biosecurity? How do I agritourism? What's a market that I can make a sustainable profit on through agritourism? And there are definitely more farmers talking about that now than when I started, and that's included in the Farmland Preservation Plan. How can the county be helpful in acknowledging some of that kind of infrastructure growth and increase in income for our farmland?
So is there anything the county is doing on that front?
They put into some ordinances in place to help farmers understand things like nutrient management planning, how to handle nutrients better so that you're using what you have on the farm, increasing your soil fertility so you can have productive yields without impacting the groundwater. UW Extension is holding classes on entrepreneurial food value-added services. The Small Business Development Center, along with UW Extension, is hosting workshops that brings the farmer in with the business development people so they can share ideas with each other and acknowledge where the gaps are. And I'm watching farmers go through that process, and that's really interesting. It's interesting for me as the agricultural person to acknowledge how far the farmer has to go and how far the businesses have to go to pull up that seam. You know, there's discussion about farm to table. Somebody I talked to yesterday was talking about having, you know, you have these pizza nights on the farm. You know, that idea some of our farmers are picking up, but it's probably more common for them to start talking about, hey, I grow grass-fed beef. That's what I know how to do, and I know there's a market that's increasing out there. How do I connect with some of those cooperatives that only want to sell grass-fed beef? Will they come up to your Douglas County? Will they take my meat? You know, and so those are the things that are starting to bubble up locally. And, you know, we have a market across the river into Duluth. How can we get our meat across state lines and their products coming here more fluently with any of the regulatory questions that have to be addressed?
Does it seem like there's any added hurdles because of that boundary issue between Minnesota and Wisconsin?
I think maybe the hurdle is that we have to understand that hurdle. Maybe it's not as big as a hurdle as we think it is. So I think we want to spend time making sure we understand that and take a leap over it and not consider it a hurdle. And that's something that I'll be working on along with the business development people to make sure we and our farmers understand it so they're not turning down ideas and anxious about things that that we can actually not be worried about.
So what's kind of the feeling among farmers then, you know, with all the changes that we've seen in recent years, you know, with low prices for commodity crops or dairy, and then, you know, we've seen the retaliatory tariffs on top of that, you know, is the feeling among farmers that, you know, this is just cyclical and what we've always dealt with, or is there kind of a sense that things are much more difficult now than they ever have been?
Yeah, I think every farmer has a different opinion, so it would be good to talk with some of them one-on-one. I know that some of them have talked about they're not going to get bigger. They're making their income increase by staying smaller and managing what they have and watching their income, their inputs, so that that they can survive as a family without increasing the debt. Now, that also means that they have to have the infrastructure from further away to come take care of them, to come from a greater distance, like coming from Eau Claire to pick up milk every day. They have to hope that that continues. But their determination to right size is going to allow them to stay where they're at on the farm. So that's one way. Some of them for sure are going to make decisions that, you know, that my kids don't want this and I'm done with it and I'm ready to try to sell my land. I'm ready to start taking on renters who want my land. There are beef producers from outside that might be interested in moving their animals up here for grazing. Some of our younger farmers is looking how to add value to their managing their hay so that they can grow higher quality hay for horse farmers or higher quality hay to ship down to the southern part of the state for dairy farmers. We can grow great hay here. If our infrastructure costs get higher, like fertilizer prices go up because of tariffs, for instance, how are our farmers, what are they going to give up? Are they going to farm fewer acres so that they can afford the high quality, growing high quality hay? Or will they not buy the fertilizer and end up growing poor quality hay and not getting a sustainable price for it? So those are some of the things that they're trying to watch and that we're trying to help them consider.
Again, you were just listening to Jane Inklum with Douglas County UW Extension. People can take part in the Resilient Farms Conference in Superior at the Douglas County Courthouse in the UW Conference Room on Tuesday, December 11th. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. When we come back, we're going to talk about what climate change may mean for the future of farming in Wisconsin. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. A recent federal report says climate change is expected to have wide-ranging impacts on the Midwest, including a decline in agricultural production. The latest volume of the 4th National Climate Assessment found rising temperatures and more frequent heavy rains are likely to cause production in the Midwest to drop to levels seen in the 1980s by 2050. The report underscores many of the findings compiled by an agricultural work group with the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. UW-Madison agronomy professor Chris Kucharik led those efforts, and he spoke with me this week about what lies ahead for farmers in the face of climate change.
There's actually quite a few impacts that we're likely to see given the diversity of agriculture that we have in the state. I guess the first thing would be, you know, as temperatures continue to warm and we have more episodes of extreme heat during the growing season, that really isn't beneficial for most of our crops. That adds additional heat stress. In some regions of the state, that it will increase the demand for water that's used for irrigation, such as in the Central Sands, you know, where they're growing potato and other vegetable crops. You know, on the colder side of things, you know, new pests and diseases will have an easier time overwintering with warmer winters. So farmers will likely be faced with, you know, managing pests and disease that they're not used to. And there will also likely be an increased competition of our crops with other weedy species that are already a problem, but that's likely to increase moving forward. Increased variability in weather. I think this is one that farmers will always say they're always dealing with, you know, from year to year. But some of the more important things we're likely to see is the increased frequency of heavy rainfall events that will cause more soil erosion, more runoff. It's going to make it more difficult for them to manage inorganic fertilizers like nitrogen that they apply to their crops, as well as manure spreading. Unfortunately, heavier rainfall, more erosion creates a scenario of more leaching of things like nitrate to groundwater. And with more surface runoff, you know, we're likely to see more phosphorus and nitrate end up in surface waters, contributing to the water quality problems that we have ongoing. That increased variability in temperatures will likely lead to more what we would call false springs like we had in 2012, where we had 2 weeks of 80-degree-plus temperatures in March. That were unfortunately followed by freezing temperatures. That warm weather caused a lot of crops and fruit crops to go through a rapid transition to flowering stage. And unfortunately, I think in that year, a lot of the apple and cherry crops in our state were devastated by the way that variability in springtime weather played out, unfortunately. So, you know, we're likely to see more growing seasons like we had in 2012, which had a lot of extreme heat and drought, as well as what we just experienced in 2018, where we had excessively wet conditions over a large part of the state. Those types of conditions will occur more frequently. On the dairy side, in terms of, like, animals, the heat stress on animals will likely go up as temperatures go up. We know that could contribute to a decrease in milk production without new investments and facilities made by farmers in the coming years. And I think, you know, all these examples of problems that I've addressed, particularly those with crop growth and production, there's a lot of people counting on advances in plant breeding and genetics or biotechnology to ward off some of those potential losses. That's a big reason why we've been able to increase crop production, you know, over the last, you know, 50 or 60 years. And the question is, can those advances continue to happen quickly enough so that we can give the farming community an opportunity to adapt, or will the changes in weather and climate happen too quickly for those to take hold? And I think some of these largely, yeah, we've talked about in the Wiki report previously. I think some of these are some of the main points that are coming out of the new assessment report out of the current administration.
Definitely, you know, what we're seeing with the precipitation and soil erosion. You know, I was going to ask you something related to the soil erosion piece of that, because you mentioned, you know, it's causing things like leaching to groundwater. Are there ways that farmers are trying to deal with that right now, you know, what we're seeing with the increased precipitation to prevent some of those things?
There's management. They can manage the timing of the application of nutrients that they put on to a certain extent. You know, the more that they could split up applications into smaller amounts, the better. So, you know, rather than putting on all of the crop's needs for nitrogen fertilizer in one application in the spring, which then makes it prone to a lot of leaching with one heavy rainfall event, you know, they can spread those out over a series of applications. But that's often difficult for, you know, depending on what the crop type is. Farmers in the Central Sands, you know, they're on obviously a sandier soil. A lot of them, you know, use a practice called fertigation, where they're actually mixing the nitrogen in with the irrigation water. And so every time they irrigate, there's a small amount of nitrogen that makes it on, which reduces the ability of heavy rains to actually, you know, move that nitrate through the root zone and into the groundwater system. You know, on the flip side, in terms of manure management, that's, you know, really difficult. You know, there's ways to, you know, manage the timing of that and make sure you're not applying, you know, under certain conditions that would be more prone to having that wash away with erosion. But, you know, farmers are really tasked with, you know, trying to combat Mother Nature, and sometimes even the tools that they have at their disposal aren't enough to obviously ward off the loss of nutrients.
I know you said that there's the genetic modification that's been taking place that has, correct me if I'm wrong, has allowed us to adapt to the changes in growing conditions. If we can't engineer that, then what could Wisconsin possibly see, or what could be some of the changes in store then as far as agriculture? Will we have to change crops that are grown in the state, or...
Yeah, I think that's you know, one of the most important questions, thinking out in the long term, is what will our climate be suitable for, you know, in 50 or 75 years from now. Some people will point to the South, northern Missouri, southern Illinois, and say, hey, you know, they're still growing corn and soybeans there. They have higher yields than we do here. You know, we should be okay. And there is some truth to that, but I think the problem is that there might be some analogs or examples of climate that we might be faced with that don't actually exist right now anywhere in the Midwest. So it's really hard to look at another location that you might say, well, you know, Wisconsin might be like Missouri, you know, by 2070 or something like that. Some of these are the types of examples that people throw out there, but it's really hard to predict that, and so it really, you know, does come down to, you know, a lot of these advances in the breeding and genetics, selecting, you know, for traits that, let's say for corn, to be more drought resistant. And I think a lot has happened, let's say, since the last major drought we had before 2012, which was 1988, that, you know, if we hadn't had that happen and there hadn't been an emphasis on breeding for better drought resistance, maybe 2012 would have ended up even worse than it was. So I think it's a mix. I mean, we're on the northern fringes of a primary global region that grows a lot of corn and soybeans. You know, I think that those are going to be part of our landscape, but, you know, it might become more and more difficult to sustain the high yields moving forward given the growing conditions. That's kind of what we're looking at. And there's always a possibility that there might be different crops that might do better here given the type of climate we have. I think the problem is, how do you transition, an economy from one sort of set of crop types to another that's going to provide an economically viable option for growers? So it's very important to look forward and try to use that, in terms of planning.
Again, you were just listening to Chris Kucharik, agronomy professor at UW-Madison. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. When we come back, we'll review some of the news of the week. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. And up next, we take a look back on some of the news of the week. Superior Mayor Jim Payne is kicking off his re-election campaign at the Carnegie Library in Superior on Saturday. The first-time mayor says he's running again because he wants to continue work that will build the city into a place where people are proud to live. If re-elected next spring, Payne says his priorities will be housing, wages, economic development, and outdoor recreation.
So we want to make sure that we're improving our housing stock, but in a way that's meaningful and important to neighborhoods. That's saving old and historic houses, helping people improve their own homes. We're also trying to get wages up by fighting for working people, fair wages, good benefits, providing stable jobs for working people. And finally, development, improving our retail economy, improving our downtown business districts, and making sure that people have fun places to go, not just for the things that they need, but fun places to shop so they have fun things to do so people will come to this community.
Payne cites two new housing developments as some of the city's accomplishments during his term as mayor.
We've lowered taxes twice, including a historic actual drop in the total property taxes collected, first time in 33 years. We've lowered fees for the first time ever. We've added a number of festivals in the city. We brought fireworks back to Barker's Island, created the Mayor's Commission on Communities of Color to increase diversity and inclusion in both city government and in the day-to-day life of the city as well.
Superior's mayor says some of the challenges facing the city include funding improvements to infrastructure and city services like public safety. Payne was elected last year after former Mayor Bruce Hagen stepped down in the middle of his term. His campaign kickoff will be held at Superior's Carnegie Library from 1 to 3 on Saturday afternoon. So far, no other candidates have announced their run for Superior Mayor. The Public Service Commission approved a Superior Utilities request to raise electric, water, and gas rates. The utility sought an increase to pay for improvements and a projected loss of income from the Husky Energy fires in April. Superior Water, Light, and Power will draw in an additional roughly $1.3 million under the rate increase. That's about $1 million less than the utility requested. The commission approved smaller increases for electric, water, and natural gas. The company proposed the hikes in part to offset lost sales to its largest water customer, Husky Energy. The refinery isn't expected to resume normal operations until 2020. If Husky comes back online sooner, utility treasurer Paul Holt says ratepayers would see a refund.
Basically, the company will not profit from those sales because, in theory, our rate filing had lower sales for Husky.
A spokesman with the Wisconsin Citizens Utility Board says the commission recognized that larger rate increases would have been a burden on ratepayers. The City of Superior and Superior Douglas County Adult Leadership Program paired up to launch the Skates for Superior program. As Olivia Shalaby reports, the program seeks to provide free skating equipment to the public at the city's outdoor skating rinks.
Linda Cadot is the Director of Parks, Recreation, and Forestry at the City of Superior. She says the Superior Douglas County Adult Leadership Program wants to remove barriers for people who want to get out on the ice. Cadot says they are hoping to have 25 skates at the shacks for people to sign up and borrow. She says fewer people have been using the city's skating rinks.
I think a big part of that is weather, organized sports. Obviously, kids have different interests and going to play pickup games after school versus going to play computer games and so forth.
Trevor Delbeck is the Superior High School student that is working with the program for his senior project. Delbeck says he's been playing hockey for around 15 years and wants to give back to the community.
I grew up in East End, and I used to go to the Red Barn. And I remember some buddies, they didn't have skates, and just like putting that into memory and perspective, having this drive will allow like those type of kids to put on a pair of skates and, you know, skate with their buddies no matter what.
Delbeck says their goal is to collect as many skates as possible. He says they are also looking for donations of helmets, sticks, and other skating equipment. The skate drive is accepting donations from now until December 21st. Olivia Shelby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Donation bins can be found at the Westman Arena Lobby and Superior Ice Arena Lobby. State conservation wardens are investigating several cases of deer poaching across Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says there seems to be an uptick in cases this year. Wisconsin DNR Chief Conservation Warden Todd Schaller says wardens have been investigating deer poaching in Price, Eau Claire, and Washera counties. He says they're also investigating killings that occurred on the border of La Crosse and Vernon counties.
Common threads seem to be multiple deer. You know, so it's not just going out and taking a particular deer. I think another common thread is multiple suspects.
Price County Conservation Warden Joe Paul says they had two adults and 13 juveniles that illegally killed around 60 deer.
There's groups within that larger group that are responsible for the majority of the what we'll call thrill killing, where they just went out to shoot for something to do.
Paul says some deer were harvested for meat, but others were left behind. A new federal report says tribal communities in the Midwest are more vulnerable than other groups to the impacts of climate change. Changing temperatures and rainfall can affect the natural resources that they rely on to thrive and their cultural practices. The Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission has been working on a climate vulnerability assessment of 60 species important to its member tribes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. The commission's Melanie Montano says they're seeing declines in species like walleye that thrive in colder waters.
You can think about even the impacts to our diet. So eventually, if there's no walleye, is that going to impact, you know, our diets, things that have sustained us for so many years, and how is that going to change us and the health of our people?
Tribes are combining science with traditional ecological knowledge to respond and adapt to climate change. A regional food bank is seeing less demand at area food pantries in northern Wisconsin, but as Olivia Shalaby reports, food shelves in Superior, Bayfield, and Poplar are seeing more demand for their services.
That's according to Shay Morris. She's executive director of Second Harvest Northern Lakes Food Bank. The nonprofit organization serves 45 food pantries and 10,000 people each month in northern Minnesota and Wisconsin. Morris says the food bank has seen a 6% decrease in demand across northwestern Wisconsin this year.
Certainly changes happen in the economy. That's a good sign. Certainly we know our unemployment numbers are low right now. So that was probably of benefit to many people that were utilizing food shelves.
Morris says 3 years ago, the food bank served as many as 18,000 people each month. Despite the economic recovery, she says the need of food pantries around Poplar, Superior, and Bayfield rose by roughly 17 to 19% this year.
It could, again, just be high population of seniors. It could be people are working but not making an income to sustain their expense in a given monthly time frame. So those are some contributing factors.
Morris says some people across the region still face challenges putting food on the table, whether it's juggling medical expenses or rising utility costs. She says some may be living on a fixed income or struggling to find full-time work. Morris adds they often see the need increase around the holiday season.
Many families, their kids go to school with kids who are used to presents and big holiday celebrations, and I think families feel compelled to want to be able to provide, you know, that same type of holiday for themselves and their families.
Second Harvest Northern Lakes Food Bank supplies around 5.8 million pounds of food every year. Olivia Shalaby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The University of Wisconsin-Superior held a dedication ceremony this week for former art professor William Pope Wright. The university honored Wright by naming its multicultural center after the artist and educator who taught at UWS for 44 years. Sandra Wright was married to Pope Wright for 47 years. She's pleased to see the university recognize her husband and his years of service.
Pope was a first for just about everything, and I feel that he gave his all. He died with his boots on. He never retired. He loved this place, and I believe they loved him. So it is, I think, a fitting tribute, but also well appreciated.
Wright was the university's first African-American professor when he began teaching at UWS in 1971. He was also the first Black student union and Indian student advisor on campus. Former UWS Multicultural Affairs Director Chip Beal says Wright supported the center from its inception in 2000.
And he helped, he searched for better opportunities for students of color, and he was right there all the way. So to name this center after Pope is a perfect opportunity for the university.
Duluth Human Rights Officer Carl Crawford remembers the wisdom that Wright instilled in him when he was a student at UWS.
For me, it was an advisor, a neighbor, a beacon of safety. There was comfort for a young Black man so far away from home, no matter what. I knew when I saw the rights, it was going to be all right. Now, Pope Wright's fingerprints have been replaced by this recognition, never to be forgotten, that gives me great comfort.
Sandra Wright hopes people will remember the kind of person her husband was with everyone he met.
He was a wonderful person. He had time for anyone and everyone. I don't believe he ever said a cross word about anyone. He was a quiet giant, because although he was very quiet, he was very powerful.
Pope Wright passed away in 2015. The university dedicated the Multicultural Center to Wright this past Wednesday. And that's a look back on some of the news of the week, and that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.